Hi, I'm Brian Kiley, and this is Engaging Culture, a podcast presented by Bridgeway Christian Church. Pastor Judah is out this week, so I have a whole bunch of friends joining me for today's episode. First, we're going to talk about imposter syndrome. What is it? Why do we get it? And how do we get rid of it? Next, we're going to talk about making the most of our retirement years. And then finally, going to bring in Pastor Anthony for a conversation about how to maintain our confidence when we are criticized. We'll play a little blessed or stressed and have some fun along the way. All of that on this episode of Engaging Culture. Well, hello. Thank you for listening. Another episode of Engaging Culture. Brian Kiley here once again. And for my first segment, I am joined by the one and only Josh Ooh. Josh, good morning.
Good morning. How you doing, bud?
I am doing all right. How about yourself?
Doing well enough.
All right. Well enough. Okay. Best thing you saw this week?
My wife has been in a production of Seussical.
The musical?
Seussical, the musical. Yes, and it rhymes. She actually had a featured role this time in seeing her do her thing and just enjoying the heck out of it and performing at all these shows was really incredible. And we had all of our friends there for one of our nights.
Oh, that's awesome.
And it was absolutely ridiculous and super fun. And we embarrassed her after the show, as we should.
As you must. I know from talking to you, she's been working really hard on it, so it must have been really fun just to kind of see the finish.
I'm really excited that it's over.
I'm sure you are.
And so is she. Yeah. So
I feel like I hear that from theater people. Like, yeah. Man, that was great, and I'm glad it's over.
Yeah, but. Yeah. Like my daughter, when her shows are over, she cries. Yeah. When my wife's shows are over, she has sighs of relief. Yeah.
Like, rejoices.
Oh, thank God.
And there's just enough time in between, I have to assume, to kind of forget about the pain and only remember the good parts. Like, yeah, totally, I'll do that again.
Yeah, she'll do it next fall, I'm sure.
Wonderful. Cool. Well, mine was this last weekend. We did our annual elder board retreat, and that was just a fun time to get away for a couple days. Pastor Lance, myself, and then all of our elder board members, the rest of whom are not on staff, and they're just great people, and we're really fortunate here at our church to be led by good and godly folks, and I love that there is a huge amount of diversity on our board in terms of personality, in terms of skill set, in terms of interest, and yet there's a huge amount of unity. So it was a fun time just being together, having just connecting, and especially, I don't know, we do different staff things, and like we're all around each other all the time, whereas the board, we're together twice a month, and then if we see each other on the weekends. So it was cool to have that focused time.
That's great.
All right. So, Josh, I've asked you to be on this segment with me because I can only assume you are an expert in imposter syndrome.
I don't know. You're about to find out.
I kid. So for those who don't know, imposter syndrome is sort of that sense that we get that we feel like we're not good enough to do the things that we're doing, that we're going to get quote unquote found out, that people are going to realize we're not as great as they think we are. And some studies have shown that up to 70 to 80% of people deal with imposter syndrome in some manner. Even this article that we'll put in the show notes here, talked about Albert Einstein, that when he would get praised for his work,
right,
he would say it made him feel like he was an involuntary swindler. And then in 2023, 2.9 internet searches were made for the term imposter syndrome. So my first question for you, Josh, why is it, do you think, that so many of us struggle with imposter syndrome?
I think part of it has to do with our confidences. I think a lot of it has to do with the fear of both failure and the fear of success. So the article goes through a bit of both of those, that some people are unable to take credit for their successes because they're worried that now there's expectation that's going to follow them. The other side of that too is like, I know who I am, and I'm going to disappoint you at some point. Yeah. And so, like, it's almost like waiting for that shoe to drop type of a deal.
Have you experienced that before where you do something well or something? I mean, our jobs are pretty public, or you might do other things that are public, and you get a lot of credit for it. And, like, on one level, maybe that's nice. Like, that's super cool that people would encourage you. But have you experienced that kind of anxiety that comes with that?
Yeah. So when I was a worship pastor, that was a very consistent thing. Anytime you had great like holiday service, for example.
Yeah, totally.
So it's like, hey, that was our best Easter in X amount of years. Can't wait to see what you do the next one. It's like, I'm still trying to hold on to this one. You know, and I think you spoke about this in a recent episode about the Olympics of like, hey, they just won a medal. Stop asking them about the next medal that they're going to try to win. Like,
totally.
Let them soak this in. But I think so much of that in the creative realm or in performing realm is you don't know if you can duplicate this again.
Yeah.
It's not a formula that we use. And we're like, if we do these things, it'll be this great every single time.
Yeah.
And so it's super unpredictable. Because of that, anytime you have successes, it's almost like, oh man, now I've just set the bar even higher for the next one.
Yeah.
Which is a really unhealthy mindset.
Totally. And we obviously have jobs where we end up doing things in front of people quite a bit, but some of the research shows that, and well, first of all, I should say, research shows that people that are in those types of professions totally deal with imposter syndrome, right. But also those who work in medicine, in science technology fields, in academia, even among students, that there is a kind of a high level of imposter syndrome that exists there. My next question, is there any benefit that you see to having to kind of work through imposter syndrome?
I do. I think one of the things that stands out to me is that it has the recipe for humility baked in there.
Yeah.
Of saying, hey, you don't have to be an expert at everything that you're doing. And one of the things that's really interesting to me is if you talk to anybody in a doctoral program, like PhD level, not those demons, those are a dime a dozen, but those PhD programs, they get to the end of it and they say, I feel like I know less now than I did before, and yet they're at the highest level of education they can get in that specific area.
Yeah.
Part of that is because it's very narrow, but I think the burden of knowledge is the more you get, the more you realize, I don't really know.
Yeah.
And I'm kind of making this stuff up because it's intuition, it's experience, it's taking all these different fact points and making sense of them, and you could be right, you could be wrong. Yeah. And I think imposter syndrome actually forces you to wrestle, is this right, wrong, or just an opinion?
Yeah.
And it really does bring out the best in some people in some cases, not all the time. A lifestyle is not what we're going for here. Sure. Moments are fine.
Yeah. I mean, I've always said that if you are in vocational ministry and don't at least feel a little bit of imposter syndrome, like that's a bigger red flag to me than feeling none.
Right.
Just that idea of, okay, you're going to speak on behalf of God, or you're going to lead people in worship or teach God's word. And this idea to go, I am 100% qualified to do this, is like, that's not a great mindset.
It's not a great mindset. And whenever you're leading people in any organization and you're responsible for bringing people along, oftentimes you're going to have to start taking steps that are like, I don't know how this is going to turn out, but I've got to tell you that this is going to be good.
Yeah.
Or you're not going to follow.
Right. Yeah.
Like that, there's just, you don't inspire confidence of, come with me, we're probably all going to die.
Like, I don't know what I'm doing. Let's go.
Let's all jump off the hill. I hope there's water. You know, like That's not inspiring leadership.
So something else I was thinking about, just in terms of kind of why a lot of us deal with imposter syndrome, is I think that there's a lot of kind of hyper-specialization in our world today, that all of us, even if we're not, you know, PhDs, CEOs, whatever, we have kind of our lane where we are competent. And what that means is we are less competent, maybe not competent at all, in a whole bunch of other areas. And I think that because we live with ourselves all the time, what we do well is just normal. And then, I mean, I even think about, just having been with our elder board this last weekend, I think about listening to someone on our board talk about technology and talk about business and all of that. And I just go, I'm like Charlie Brown over here. I don't know anything. And yet, to hear that same person reflect on some areas of knowledge where I have a little more competence, and he just goes, yeah, I got nothing. So I think that there's something to be able to recognize, like, okay, we're not meant to be competent in everything, and the competence of someone else in an area where we're not as strong, like, doesn't mean we're imposters in everything. I don't know. Do you think there's anything to that?
I do, and I think part of that is the body of Christ that we're designed to be in community is really crucial.
Yeah.
We talk about the body of Christ with the gifts a lot, but I think it's just even perspective and knowledge base,
mm-hmm.
that we can't know everything about everything. We're not God.
Yeah.
So we need each other in order to balance each other out. I also think that there's a spiritual element to imposter syndrome that we have to recognize.
Yeah.
That one of the enemy's biggest things, especially with American culture, is to get us to do nothing.
Yeah.
And if he can get us to do nothing, that's just as good as getting us to do something bad. Like So if he can get us to a point where we're like, well, we feel like we don't have anything to offer and can get us to stay stagnant, he wins in that scenario because we're not gaining ground. We're not doing anything. We're just sitting on the sideline. And I think a lot about somebody like Paul and Peter when they're going through, you know, Paul, when he was Saul, murdering Christians. Like, right. That's what he did for fun.
Yeah.
Not fun, but, you know, but that is what his life work was to root out this cult.
Yeah.
And when he becomes saved, he refers to himself as the chief amongst sinners.
Yeah.
He knows that he has a voice within these churches and that he has a lot of pull within, especially the Gentile churches. And he knows that, yet he's still struggling with the fact that of who he was.
Yeah.
And I think that's part of it for us too. Sometimes we struggle with who we were, forgetting that Christ has redeemed us and moved us forward.
Yeah.
And so we don't have to be struggling with who we were. We get to live in who we are.
Yeah. That's really well said. And I think that that spiritual element of going, that part of the way the enemy knocks us off track is not that we, you know, go off and engage in some like egregiously sinful behavior, but we just go, I'm not good enough. I can't do it. I can't do it. And kind of that that default to nothing. Now, as we wrap up the segment, this article, which, by the way, BBC Science Focus is becoming one of my favorite news outlets on Apple News Plus. They have fascinating stuff about all sorts of like just helpful, practical ideas. That's where even I found this article that, again, we'll link to in the show notes. So that's just a little plug for BBC Science Focus. It's pretty fun. I enjoy it. But it offers us three kind of ways of kind of beating imposter syndrome. And I want to talk about them briefly. The first is, and this is quoting directly from the article, it's time to admit it. Your imposter syndrome doesn't make complete sense. The experience of feeling like an imposter is ultimately just a perception of how you see certain situations and is often based on contradicting arguments. And it goes on to quote someone who says that folks who really struggle with this, if they do well, they kind of credit external factors. And if anything goes wrong, they go, well, I've just totally failed. What do you think of that? How can we just, I don't know, take a little bit more of a facts-based approach to quieting that voice inside of us?
Yeah, one of the things that they say in that article I think is actually helpful is the achievements journal.
Yeah.
When you do something, write it down and say, I was able to do this. Mm-hmm. I actually laughed when they said starting an achievement journal may sound vomit-inducing to many. I was like, 100%. That does sound awful. It sounds like something a narcissist would do.
Totally.
However, remembering that, by the way, I can do some things.
Yeah.
Is actually really helpful. And I think it's good for us to remember our successes and to remember that we're not always the worst part of ourselves.
Yeah. You have some ability to help someone somewhere some of the time.
Correct.
Now, next, and I think this just applies to so many different areas of life. It talks about this idea of breaking the secret. And an example was even given of medical students who deal with imposter syndrome at higher levels than kind of the average person. They're just getting them to recognize, hey, you work in a place that's going to make you feel incompetent, helped them to not feel so incompetent. And then similarly, when we kind of break out of sort of our secret and kind of shame-based world of like, I'm no good, and we just kind of share that with others, that helps. There's such power, such spiritual power, I believe, in just recognizing we're not alone and inviting others into that process. What do you think?
I think that's the basis of confession and why confession is so vital for the spiritual life of a believer is when we confess our sins, we have an ability to bring people along, and we hear from folks every single time that I've ever stepped out that way. I've heard from somebody said, man, I've dealt with the same thing, or this is how this has paralleled me. It's not the, I can't believe you did that. Well, my wife has said that, but other folks, no, but like that's the kind of, I think confession just releases a lot of burden from our shoulders. And so it allows us to engage in what's positive from that point on.
This last one, I'm not sure how I feel about it. I think there's something to it, but there's a level of nuance that we probably cannot tackle in 2 minutes here. But it talks about this idea of kind of accepting failure, this idea of not being a perfectionist, kind of being willing to maybe give it less than your best and recognizing, oh my gosh, the world didn't end. I don't know, that somehow maybe failing at something or having something not go great can in some sort of backward way help with our feelings of imposter syndrome. I don't know. I'm struggling with what to think of that. That on the one hand, I think that perfectionism can destroy us. On the other hand, like, I don't love the idea of like, well, I'm going to just not try very hard. So if I fail, I have an excuse.
I feel like it's a prescription-based narcotics type of a thing where it's like in the right dose, it's going to help you. And the wrong dose, you're going to be in a methadone clinic. and so I think there is a bit of that we don't have to be our best at everything that we do, but there's certain things that we should be giving 100% in.
Yeah.
But there's some things that I don't need to give my absolute best to this one project. Good enough is a thing in certain areas. And so I think in the right doses, that kind of stuff is good. I also think that taking risks of failure helps you get comfortable with failure.
Yeah.
Because if you don't ever take a risk, you don't ever reap the reward from risk.
Yeah.
And that's a really bummer place to live.
Totally.
And you think about that within relationships, within like, when you started dating your wife, there was a moment of risk that it started off, and you can't eliminate the risk. You just have to lean into it.
Yeah.
But great benefits come from that. And it's the same with everything in life. That if we can lean in, take risks and say, hey, if I fail, this does not mean it's over. It just means that thing isn't going to work. So let's go on to the next thing and just kind of readjust.
Yeah, no, that's very well said. And I think that there's broad application of that in all sorts of different areas of life. Sure. All right, Josh, thanks for being with us. I appreciate it. And we'll be right back. We are back, and for this segment, I've got Pastor Anthony Lipscomb with me. Anthony, how's it going?
Hey, doing good.
Good. Thank you for coming on the episode. Really appreciate it. And we're going to talk about an article that Pastor Heather actually sent me, kind of suggesting it for the podcast. And the headline is How to Stay Confident When You're Being Criticized. I think most would agree that criticism is sort of just part of life, right?
That's right.
I think if you want to do anything of value, you are going to be criticized. And if you're not being criticized at all, you're probably not trying anything.
Exactly.
Yeah. And I don't know, I guess, but that element of kind of how we connect confidence and criticism, or how we remain appropriately confident in the face of criticism, that's tricky, and we're going to talk through some strategies for that. But first of all, just in your own life, how do you kind of navigate that, kind of maintaining a sense of confidence when you are criticized, or how do you find that criticism affects you?
You know, it's not easy, right? It's never easy to hear criticism, and you know, some people like myself, I feel like I'm my own worst critic, right? And so I tend to find myself jumping the gun on the criticism, and when someone else comes around and might offer criticism, they're probably repeating something I've already had in my head, right? And, you know, that might make me feel worse. It's like, okay, so and it, this actually is real. It is, this isn't just in my head, right? But yeah, for me, I've had a long growth journey of dealing with criticism, mm-hmm. Growing up, and having to learn to wrestle with it, and then having a coming of age type of season in my life where I've had to learn to see myself in a different light, where my criticism, self-criticism, criticism of others doesn't define me.
Yeah.
And so at this point where I am now, I mean, I'm my 40s now, and mm-hmm. I think I've reached a spot where I have a healthy balance, I think, of being able to take criticism and say, okay, well, what can I learn from this?
Yeah, yeah. No, I think that's huge, right? Because there are obviously two extremes we can fall into. One is where we just let criticism destroy us, and then mm-hmm. the other is where we're defensive in the face of criticism and don't let criticism be an opportunity to grow, right? Mm-hmm. I remember one quote I heard a while ago that really resonated with me was, don't take criticism from anyone you wouldn't take advice from.
Oh, that's good.
And I think that's really helpful just because, especially like our jobs are somewhat public or, you know, whatever, or just different places you might face criticism. I mean, shoot, I remember this hasn't happened recently, but even in like my early years of coaching sports, like just kind of random mm-hmm. weird criticism from parents of athletes who like the parents are not involved in what's going on. They just are kind of wanting to make things difficult. And you're just going like, yeah, I don't care. Like, I'm just not going to deal with that. And I think to be able to put criticism in its proper place to go, okay, is this somebody who's trying to help me get better?
Mm-hmm.
Is this somebody who is pointing out a legitimate error? And if kind of the answer to those questions is yes, then you're like, okay, it's time to kind of take my medicine and just sort of deal with it. But I think that it's important to recognize that in a world where everyone has a voice, in a world where anyone can be criticized or say something critical at any time for any reason, you just have to be able to go, okay, what do I actually need to listen to and what's just not helpful, right?
Yes.
So this article recommended a few different strategies for maintaining a healthy sense of confidence in the midst of criticism. And I want to just kind of get your take on the four of these. So first of all, it says, remind yourself that confidence is a belief, not a feeling. Talk to us about that.
Yeah, well, you know, when I covered this preparing for our talk, you know, it came to, I think, okay, I want to pause. Yeah, so the idea that confidence is a belief, not a feeling, I think there's a both and aspect to this.
Mm-hmm.
The belief might encourage a feeling of confidence, and the feeling of confidence might actually help you grow in your belief, right? So I don't think that there is a strict dichotomy between the belief and feeling, but there are, you know, when you're growing in your confidence, you do have to struggle against issues of maybe anxiety, insecurity, where you have to just tell yourself a narrative of confidence, right? And that will grow the belief, even if the feeling isn't there yet.
Yeah.
And I think that's really important to provide a pattern of thinking that is confidence and that allows you to work through and against any debilitating fears or insecurities.
Yeah, it is kind of amazing. Those of us, and I very much resonate with that idea of kind of my own worst critic, like we talk to ourselves in a way that, first of all, we would never talk to anyone else, and that we would never tolerate anyone else talking to us.
That's right.
So it's amazing how much we can kind of sabotage ourselves and sort of get past what I was saying earlier, that kind of that place of sort of appropriate, helpful criticism mm-hmm. into this kind of self-defeating mindset. And I love the idea of talk to yourself like you talk to someone you love, which I don't do all the time. I can still be pretty mean to myself, as I'm sure you can relate with yourself. But and I even like the idea of going, okay, confidence is a belief, not a feeling. And that on some level, confidence is something that helps us overcome fear and anxiety, that it's not actually the absence of those things.
That's right.
Next, acknowledge and validate your emotional response to criticism. Talk to us about that one.
Yeah, this requires some self-awareness, right? Being aware in the moments of what I'm feeling and being able to put a name on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's okay. And letting ourselves know it's okay to feel what I'm feeling in the moment.
Yeah.
And I'm not bad for feeling this.
Yeah. Say more about that idea of putting a name on it. What do you mean by that?
Yeah. So our emotions can get mixed, right? We don't always just experience one emotion at one time. Sometimes they're a mix of things. Mm-hmm. Uncertainty, feeling uncertain about something, feeling fearful, feeling anxious. And there's all sorts of nuance around that. But being able to identify what I'm feeling in the moment. Okay, I'm feeling stressed out because I've got all these eyes on me. Mm-hmm. I'm feeling very anxious because I don't want to disappoint someone,
yeah.
Right? So being clear in our own heads of what we're feeling and why we're feeling will help us have a clear idea of what the obstacle is that we're encountering.
Yeah. The article says, when we avoid our emotions, we teach our brains to see them as threats and dangerous, which only makes them harder to handle. And that's a really interesting way to me of framing that. I know in a lot of the research I've done on empathy that a key part of being able to empathize with others is exactly what you just described, that kind of sense of, okay, let me just identify and pay attention to and try to get underneath my own feelings in the sense that I'm really getting down to like, okay, what is actually going on here? What to you what are some of the problems if we don't do that? If we kind of, okay, I just want to kind of push through. I don't want to pay attention to how I'm feeling. What are some of the risks of that?
Yeah, so the risk, I think, is just falling into this cycle of, okay, we experience a certain emotion, anxiety, maybe even shame, and we ignore it, and we never learn to get past it. We never grow past it. And so it's that difference between a growth mindset versus a fixed mindset. Mm-hmm. And when we avoid the important issue of struggling through that, we allow that emotion to have more control in our lives than really is necessary. We can learn to have some victory over that when we confront it.
Mm-hmm. Next, it says de-identify with the criticism. It says occasionally when people criticize us, they are literally attacking our character and who we are as a person. But it is much more common that in a situation where someone is criticizing our work or our actions, we interpret it as an attack on ourselves as people. When in reality, they're just talking about this specific situation. They're not saying you're bad as a person. They're saying, well, this was not great, this one thing. Mm-hmm. Why do you think, first of all, we tend to identify with criticism so strongly? And what are some ways we can kind of separate that a little bit?
Yeah, I think the way we talk sometimes helps contribute to that. When we say I, we use that first person pronoun.
Yeah.
I did this, or I failed at this. I failed a class.
Yeah.
It's hard to separate that I from the action that we do.
Yeah.
And so they get blended together.
Yeah.
The performance gets blended with the I of who we are.
Yeah.
And it's hard to separate that in our minds. But having the patience to be able to slow down and think through, okay, who I am is not defined by this singular performance, right? I can go back. I can try to make things right. If it's a moral failure, if it's a performance, job work related, what can I do to make it better and to demonstrate that I have the resilience to overcome and work through?
Something that I've seen is that oftentimes folks who really struggle to de-identify with criticism tend to get extremely defensive in the face of criticism. So maybe it's your spouse, maybe it's a coworker, or whomever, somebody that you're in consistent communication with, and they say, hey, this wasn't great, or this hurt my feelings, or I didn't appreciate this, or hey, you said this would be done at this time and it's not. And what happens, and I've just, unfortunately, I have a lot of experience with this, is because folks cannot recognize, no, we're talking about this project that was not up to standard. We're not talking about you as a human being. What happens is again, there's just massive defensiveness and sometimes anger and sometimes kind of this really intense reaction to what is meant to be, hey, we're talking about this thing. We're not talking about your value as a person. But at the same time, I have some sympathy with that perspective because I think it's really difficult to not experience things as a personal attack, especially for folks who maybe grew up in environments where they were criticized a lot or where there was a lot of inappropriate criticism. But I think that that is such critical work for us to do, that when we find ourselves getting really emotional in response to criticism, we just have to pause for a second and go, okay, what is being criticized here?
Right.
Being criticized is the story I told in the sermon, that it wasn't great and it didn't land and it was too long and it wasn't funny. What is not being criticized here is my value and worth as a human being.
Right.
But again, that can be hard to do.
Yeah. And, you know, what you were saying about, you know, people who might have a backstory where there's some wounding, maybe some trauma, that rears its head in a response to criticism. And, you know, I think that's really important to be able to recognize that in our own stories, to take stock of our own stories, but also as we are engaging others, to extend some grace.
Yeah.
You know, if we are the ones that are trying to provide some hopefully constructive feedback, that we can not be taken by surprise, be open to any kind of reaction and be able to help someone along.
Yeah, absolutely. The last one is thank someone for their criticism. That seems a little counterintuitive, doesn't it? What is the value of that?
I think this is an excellent strategy for having victory over the potential of criticism to deflate us.
Yeah.
Right? Being able to say thank you is a power move, I think, for our own psyche, our own way of dealing with maybe past patterns of working through criticism or avoiding it, and creates a new way of turning the criticism into an opportunity to learn, to grow. Right. It's going back to that growth mindset. Thank you for that. And then following up to de-escalate your emotion in the situation in that moment, following up with the thanks of maybe, do you have any ideas of like how I could have done that better?
Yeah.
Right. And so then you turn it into sort of a workshop of how you can improve upon and you can get maybe pull out of the person that's providing the feedback, maybe a more constructive voice that you need to hear.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that idea of recognizing that good criticism from somebody who ultimately desires your best, like that is a gift.
Yes.
It is an extraordinary gift. Mm-hmm. I mean, I've had times where I've had people come to me, and I'm just going to speak in extremely vague terms because I don't have permission to share specific stories, where somebody has said, hey, this thing involving your child wasn't great, or hey, this thing that, you know, involving you wasn't great. And I've done that. I've said, thank you. It would have been really easy for you to say nothing. It would have been really, like, you didn't know how I was going to react to this. Yeah. So you took a risk in letting me know about this situation where some correction is necessary, either with myself or with somebody else. And you've given me the opportunity to address this situation. Thank you. Mm-hmm. And even, you know, I was telling you the other day about how I've utilized ChatGPT for sermon reviewing a little bit, where I'll upload videos and I'll ask for criticism. And the robot does not care about your feelings, man. Like, it'll just tell you. But, like, that's such a gift to go, okay, now I can get better. So I think there's a lot of value in seeing, okay, I guess in sort of having the posture of going, no, I want to see constructive criticism, not angry criticism, not nitpicking, as a gift to help me get better in areas of life that matter to me. But it can be difficult to maintain that posture. Easy to say sitting here.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think another avenue, another domain of life experience that will help us be better at receiving criticism, processing it, is when we are in a position to provide that criticism to someone else. For me, it's parenting. It's totally like the great laboratory of you know, unfortunately, kids are the guinea pigs in our maturation process.
Totally.
But, you know, if we take time to evaluate and see how our criticism lands with the people that we love, we can learn a lot from that. And there's going to be a lot of requesting of forgiveness, sure. and hopefully that takes place.
Yep.
But we can definitely learn a lot from that. And, you know, just as a dad, just help, and volunteer parent coach with my son's team, being able to see not only just, okay, what do these kids need improvement on, but also to explain to them why there's improvements, like, yeah. and help them see when you do this, when you make this correction, this is going to be the payoff,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
And so just like to tell the story, because a lot of times when we give a criticism, we may have more in our heads than we actually say. And so people can just take that little morsel that we actually verbalize
yeah.
and build a whole narrative in their mind around it.
That's a good
without
point.
Having the full context of what we are thinking yeah. and like what we have like of best interest for them.
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. So we'll link to the article in the show notes. Think there's some good insight there in how we deal with criticism, how we maintain our confidence. Pastor Anthony, I have no criticism for you on this segment. Great stuff.
Thank
I appreciate
you,
it.
All right.
We'll be right back. For our next segment, I am joined in the studio by Mark and Lisa Rome. They are the leaders of our Bridge Builders ministry here at Bridgeway. Mark and Lisa, thanks for coming in and being with me. I appreciate it.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, it's a privilege to be here.
So I asked you to come here because of an article I saw in Christianity Today that really caught my attention. And the article is written by a gentleman in his early 60s. He is a chancellor at a Christian college, and this is what he says. He says, "Not long ago, I visited my 99-year-old father and 97-year-old mother. My dad had just passed his driver's test again, and a year before that, he published yet another book. He told me he wants to take up painting again. Then, with a mischievous look in his eye, my dad turned to me, a 60-something baby boomer, and said, 'Son, what are you going to do with yourself? You've got your whole life ahead of you.' And it goes on to say how 100 years ago, that would have been nonsense. For him to be alive at 60 would have been kind of an outlier. But shifts are taking place. A lot of Americans living longer than ever, and that has caused a lot of adjustments in society, particularly the way we view retirement years. But I know the two of you are passionate about this topic, and even as a very non-retired person, I am as well. But I want to start with, what are kind of some ways that we think through the retirement time period in maybe less than healthy ways, either in the way that churches view retired folks or the way that retired folks kind of think about their life and service to the church and the world? Lisa, we'll start with you and then go
sure.
to Mark.
So I think that one of the situations that we deal with is the older generation, myself included, sometimes can feel undervalued, but we also forget that we have to be willing to step forward and raise our hand and say yes from time to time. There are certainly things that if we look in the Word where it gives us many, many examples of people that were in their 80s, 90s, and above. And this wasn't when they were living to be 900 either. Yeah. This was people that were now living into their 80s and 90s and still finding incredible things that God had for them to do.
Yeah. I mean, I think about Titus and 2 Timothy both like really specifically talk about this idea of older men train up younger men, older women train up younger women, that's a huge part of how our faith is passed on, is that sense of involvement. And there's kind of, it goes both ways, right? Like
right.
younger folks need to seek it out, and then
yes.
older folks need to be willing to offer it. Right?
For sure. For sure.
Mark, how about you?
Well, I was just thinking about the fact that we have a tendency, as we're young, thinking, oh, someday I'm going to be retired and I can just sit in a recliner and, you know, do whatever on the front porch. And that doesn't apply once you get here.
Yeah.
We can step right into that, especially I think part of this is that you've worked your fanny off for all these years and next Thursday is my last day.
Yeah.
So what am I going to do tomorrow?
Yeah.
And we've thought a lot about preparing for Thursday to be our last day, but we haven't necessarily thought about what am I going to do the day after that?
Yeah.
And don't get me wrong, there's nothing wrong with vacationing. There's nothing wrong with whatever you want to do. Take a year.
Yeah.
But there's a point where you know, really have free time. And for me, retirement is owning my own time.
Yeah.
I get up every morning and go, what am I going to do today?
Yeah.
And I choose. And so that's the key to tapping into all of this, you know, reality,
yeah,
potential, valuable skill set is, am I going to decide I'm going to do something with it?
It's been interesting for me watching my parents. My mom's been retired for a little bit. My dad's just been fully retired for the last couple of years. And it has been an interesting thing to watch them kind of adjust to that. And even in things like recognizing, wow, there's a lot of time. And I get my hyperactivity in terms of wanting to be out and about doing stuff from my dad. So he's always like wanting to do stuff. Let's play pickleball. Let's ride our bikes. Let's play golf, whatever. And, but even seeing them process that sense of going, okay, recreation is great and I've worked really hard and I want to have more time for recreation. And certainly I would validate that and hey, good for you. But also that sense of looking for some way to contribute. And Mark, I know you're really involved at the Salvation Army and the benefit, right? You just said retirement is owning your own time. You get to do what you want to do because you're not worried about what can I get someone to pay me to do. And I know you get a lot of fulfillment from your work at the Salvation Army.
Yeah, the Salvation Army has been great for me. I mean, it's a family tradition. I have an uncle that retired as an officer, and so we've known about it for years. But the nice thing for me is I can go there, and like we were just talking about, I can go there some days, and they say, oh, we got to move 2,000 boxes. And I, oh, I hear my mom calling me. I got to go, you know, or whatever. I'm not going to do that. And yeah, part of it is I don't want to be sore for a month, right, or potentially longer.
Right.
You know, I've had a rough year and had knee replacement, and my surgeon was a solid Christian guy. Mm-hmm. And every time I've seen him, he really kind of rides me and gets on my case about what are you going to do with this, you know, this temple that God has given you.
Yeah.
And so there's a big part of retirement that's really about taking care of yourself, like you were saying, yeah, ride your bike, play pickleball, find a crew to do that with,
yeah,
and have a reasonable amount of time that you spend your week doing that.
Yeah.
But also don't forget, you know, we really need to do eternally valuable,
absolutely,
stuff.
Now, Lisa, you've had a couple of interesting experiences that I'd like for you to share. The first is, talk to me about a women's retreat you went on, okay, where you found yourself and some of your peers looking around for kind of who are the wise ones who can impart, right, wisdom, right, to the young, and,
right,
and sort of God led you to a pretty startling realization in that moment.
Exactly. So it was actually on the drive to the retreat that I was talking with one of my dear friends, and we were looking for somebody to be pouring wisdom into us and felt like this one had moved away, this one was gone. Who are we going to be gleaning from? And all of a sudden looked at one another and thought, well, wait a minute. We're now the older women.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. And so it was like, okay, the word tells us that the older women are to teach the younger women to love their husbands and to be keepers of the home. How can we now begin to impart that to that next generation,
yeah,
not just our own children, but now who can we begin to example to and spend time with so that we can teach them some of those very basic things, whether it's how to keep a decent house so that people could come over at any time and enjoy being with your family and things like that. And so, you know, both of us at that point realized we needed to step it up a notch. It,
yeah,
wasn't just about taking care of our own any longer. We had a bigger job to do.
Keeping your home so that people can come over to it at any time. I'm feeling personally attacked right now.
Sorry,
so
about
if
that,
we could just move on to something else. I'm just teasing. But you're right. That's just that idea of kind of imparting practical life wisdom. Now, you also had another experience when you were starting out in ministry because, mm-hmm, you served as a children's pastor, and you were looking for support from those who had come before you and found that to be pretty lacking.
Exactly. In fact, this one particular gal that I had gone to, I was researching to find people that could come and work in some of the children's ministry classes. There had been a lull for a period of time at the particular church. And so I went to the previous children's director and, yeah, said, hey, can you help me out? And she very kindly said, oh, sweetie, I've already done that. And so, no, unfortunately, I can't help you. And right then and there is when I kind of made a decision in my mind. I didn't want to be that person.
Yeah.
And again, like we've already stated, it's not that you can't take vacations,
sure,
but to not even make yourself available to somebody that's coming behind you in your footsteps,
yeah,
and saying, sorry, gal, I'm just too busy.
Well, that sense to be able to go, okay, I can, maybe I'm to the point where I'm not going to be in the classroom on the floor with the kids, or I'm not going to be working 40, 50 hours a week, but to even to recognize, hey, where do I have some knowledge, whether it's church related or outside, where I can just be of benefit to kind of send the elevator back down for those who are just sort of figuring it out and then helping them rise up. Like, there's such opportunity there. Now, Mark, I want to talk a little bit more about this idea of just kind of like the kingdom impact potential that exists in retirement, that, once again, totally a place for recreation. But there's all sorts of studies out there that indicate that folks who really struggle in retirement kind of don't have a plan, like you said, for sort of how there's a lot of time here, a lot of hours. How am I going to fill them with something meaningful? Why do you think, just from a very practical, like, life satisfaction standpoint, why do you think it's important for folks in your season of life to find an area where they're investing in others or investing in kingdom work?
Well, one of the things would be, we all have a skill set, and find where you're strong and probably aim in that direction.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean you have to be fixing people's cars, but you can sure give them good advice.
Right.
And also, you have to manage this, because most organizations love volunteers and they will hop on your back and ride you till you collapse. And so,
churches never do that though, right? Never.
Yeah. So you also have to find a way to pace yourself.
Yeah.
And I know we've grown up in the church, both of us, Lisa and I, and we've seen that happen, and then also had it happen to us.
Yeah.
And where I have to step back and go, wow, the plane's going down. Some of the stuff needs to go overboard, or we're going to crash hard.
Yeah.
And so that's a key to this. And I just to reiterate, I believe find your skill set and stay in that.
Yeah. How have you seen that, Lisa? Just the importance, even just for you personally, of going, okay, in my retirement years, I want to have places where I'm making investments, where I'm pouring into others, where I'm serving in some capacity beyond recreation. What kind of an impact has that made for you?
Absolutely. So I think one of the things I would like to bring up is, just a number of months back, Mark and I were chatting, and he said, so babe, when are you done? And I looked at him and I said, well, we happen to have 10 grandkids. The oldest is only 11.
Wow.
And I said, babe, when all 10 of them are faithfully serving Jesus, then I'm done.
Hmm.
Now, for me, that means years down the road, because sure, childhood conversion, and I am one, yeah, who was converted as a child. I know it makes a difference, but I want to see my grandkids, the Lord, if he allows me to stay around this long, yeah, to be able to be passing that on to their children someday,
yeah,
and knowing the value and the importance of that. And so we set ourselves up and in involvement with children. Yeah. I work now weekly in Kids Way, mm-hmm, and in that age group of 6 and 7 year olds, which is when I gave my heart to Jesus,
yeah,
and get to teach children week after week how real he is and the influence that he's been in my life.
Yeah. Yeah. That's amazing. What would you say to the person, and either one of you can jump in on this one, what would you say to the person that's kind of sitting here going, okay, I'm not really sure where to start, that maybe they've retired, they're no longer working, they're kind of trying to figure their lives out? Because I do think, you know, Mark, to your point from earlier, I suspect, just from kind of observing other folks, that a lot of people do step into that, like, okay, my last day's Thursday, I don't really have much of a plan for Friday and beyond. What would you say to the person who is trying to figure out, how do I strike that balance of, okay, and retirement is something to be enjoyed, and then part of that enjoyment is in serving others, but I'm just kind of, okay, calendar's open, what do I do?
I think that you've got to change your mindset. A lot of times we get into our age group and it's like, well, it's time for you to serve me. And I don't mean in huge ways, but you should make things comfortable for me. And we deal with that at the church all the time, of people like, oh, the music's too loud. Oh, the, you know, and we're actually in a big transition here at Bridgeway, yeah, to, you know, to work with that.
Sure.
But I think that you look at your local church. I mean, one of our foundations, and I'll plug our Bridge Builders Ministry, is we like to provide opportunities for you to serve. Mm-hmm. And some of them are super easy. You know, obviously you can do a lot. We're plugged into the Salvation Army, so we can provide you a lot of opportunities to work 3 hours a week.
Yeah.
And then from that, it starts bridging out and you start feeling more comfortable with stuff and you start understanding what this looks like. Oh, I don't have to get up and wear a suit, you know, whatever. Mm-hmm. And you just look around and find opportunities. And one of the things is you have to decide, I'm going to do this for myself. I'm not going to wait till someone comes and asks me or drops it in my lap.
Yeah, that sense of initiative, it's really important. Yeah. Lisa, anything you'd add to that?
Yeah, I was thinking that to shadow somebody is an opportunity as well. Yeah. Look at your current friends that are maybe in retirement years and what are they doing? Does something appeal to you? And if it does, go to one of them and say, hey, can I follow you around at your next time that you go to at the food closet, for example, go serve there. There are places that you can be effective without having to have the Bible in front of you and preaching a sermon.
Sure.
And our lives make so much of a difference. You know, I mean, I remember when one of our daughters who's a nurse and she said, you know, as a retired person, they're looking for people to go and hold babies at a hospital.
Yeah.
There are so many things that we can do that blesses our community, not just our church.
Yeah. And that blesses the person doing it as well.
Absolutely.
Right? Like how many people are out there that like, oh my gosh, to hold babies, that would just be the highlight of my day, right?
Yep.
And I think that's the part that we too often miss when it comes to serving is we kind of can get so heavy-handed about it, but to recognize, no, like this is for your benefit as well. So the article had a paragraph that, Mark, you were pointing out that I really liked, and we'll just kind of wrap up with this. But it said this, that regardless of when we decide to stop full-time work, we dare not neglect the new opportunities for ministry in our families, communities, and churches in the latter years of our lives. If we are wise, we must consider how we can serve the Lord and His kingdom in the extra years He has graciously given us. The two of you are living that out right now, and it's an inspiration to me and to others. And there is, I know you would testify to this, great joy in being able to do
yes,
that.
Yes, it is. Yeah. Absolutely. Thank you. Yep.
No, it is, for me, a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I mean, I get up and look forward to it.
Yeah.
I've created situations where if I get up and I'm not looking forward to it, I can opt out. And that's not to say that every minute of every time we do anything is all, you know, bells and whistles or whatever. Yeah. But there is a part of some of the ministry is just hard work.
Yeah.
You know, just put your head down and close your mouth and get busy.
Not a lot of places to make a great impact with at least some difficulty along the way.
Exactly. There's pushback.
Yeah.
So I think that from that standpoint, I was a high school teacher and actually taught in industrial arts. And I learned later in my career when I'm talking about go do something, not to name things.
Hmm.
Because like Lisa named nursing. So it's naturally our bent to go, oh, how could I go nurse? That's not it. I wouldn't name names because then my kids would laser focus on whatever I just said and get caught up in that. It really is a back. We've already touched on this, a part of find what you like.
Yeah.
And there's, oh my, it's endless, the opportunities to invest time in something kingdom-minded. And the other thing with that is that, you know, some stuff that we look at as, well, that's not very churchy or that's not very, you know, Jesus-y.
Yeah.
But it really is.
Yeah.
And we're told if it's good, it's of God.
Yeah. Serve the Lord while
exactly,
doing it.
Exactly. Right.
Amen. Mark and Lisa, appreciate everything you do here at Bridgeway, and I appreciate you joining me.
Thank you
on this
again.
Episode.
Thank you.
All right, we'll be right back. All right, for our last segment, I have brought Josh back, and we're going to do another round of Blessed or Stressed. And the way this works is we each bring some sort of story, cultural topic, something happening in the world, and we talk about it, and then the other person has to say if they are blessed or stressed by it, and then the original presenter will say that as well. So, Josh, are you ready?
Oh, I'm ready.
You are going to be either blessed or stressed. So this story comes from the Wirecutter from the New York Times, one of the better sort of consumer product whatever websites that I've found. And it's a few months old, but I stumbled on it the other day. The headline is this: Gen Z is bringing back vintage point and shoot cameras. So the article says this: cell phones are out, vintage digital cameras are in. I don't make the rules, the author says, but apparently Gen Z does. And it goes on to talk about how vintage cameras are making this huge comeback. And they say that there is an element of kind of everything old is new again, which we've seen across society in a lot of different ways. And that's just sort of, you know, the circle of life and how it goes. But there are legitimate reasons why people aren't buying new, inexpensive, good quality point and shoot cameras. They don't exist, right? There are very few of them. So compact cameras that are like good for shooting digital photos are costing hundreds of dollars, but demand is going up. I mean, they're all over eBay, they're every place, because young people want digital cameras, not something that they can just use on their phone. Josh, are you blessed or stressed by young people leading the charge in the comeback of the digital camera?
I'm stressed that you call digital cameras vintage.
They are extremely vintage.
I hate you with everything inside me at this moment.
Wow.
The digital cameras weren't a thing when I was in high school. I don't feel like I'm old enough for something to be post-high school and be vintage. So this stresses me out.
Yeah. Oh, I should add, not only are they bringing back point-and-shoot digital cameras, but disposable cameras are making a comeback. In fact, Wirecutter evaluates the Kodak Funsaver and the Fujifilm QuickSnap Flash 400, both of which just give me memories of outdoor ed in elementary school.
Yeah. And my daughter took one to Hume Lake.
And?
Could not figure out where to see the picture after she took it. So she took 6 photos when we bought her, and they are expensive.
Yes,
by
they
the
are.
Way. Mm-hmm. These throwaway cameras that used to be like 17 cents and you got like chocolate with it back in our day.
It's like a pack of baseball cards, yeah, like with the bubble gum stick in.
Yeah, I don't know. Cracker Jack sold it as a promotion. I don't know. But she took like 6 photos the whole time because she didn't want to waste the film and she didn't know if they were good photos.
Yeah.
And I was like, yeah, I remember these days. But they were so cheap back then. We would take 40 pictures on 2 cameras and then keep 20 of them.
And the mystery, right? Of like, are these photos going to be any good?
Yeah. And where do you get film developed?
Oh,
now?
You can still get it developed at any
where?
Old place. I mean, you can get it at, you know, the Walgreens by my house does. So, but
I guess
to your
I don't
point.
Frequent Walgreens enough.
Well, that's your first
problem.
Sorry,
Grandpa Kylie.
That's your first problem. Okay. So other than me stressing you out with the idea of something that did not exist when you were in high school, calling it vintage, are you blessed or stressed by the fact that Gen Z wants to move away from phone cameras and wants the point-and-shoot variety?
I'm actually pretty blessed by it.
Okay.
And the reason for that is I think the more we can get away from these computers and life sucks that are phones, the happier we're going to be as people.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at anxiety levels and depression levels and societally how much more we're medicating these things and needing to drive it, and it coincides with the rise of the smartphone.
Yep.
Perfectly. Like this is, I think this is only good things for people.
Yeah.
It'll be a fad. It'll disappear. Just like cassettes being cool again has, you know, there's,
bring back the cassette.
There are cassette parties. It's a real thing.
God bless America.
Okay.
Yeah, God
bless those little hipsters.
So, but yes, I'm with you on the idea of like, hey, getting away from our phones, generally a good thing. Okay. What's yours?
So in the last 5 years, specifically in 2023, audiobook revenue grew $2
billion. $2
billion. That is a 9% increase over 2022.
Okay.
So in any industry to experience a 9% increase is pretty drastic.
What do they attribute it to? Or do they attribute it to anything?
We'll get there.
Okay.
So the audiobook market is expected to reach $13 billion
Holy
by 2029 with an annual growth rate of 10.4%.
Hang on, sorry. $13 billion book sales? Because there are not 13 billion people on planet Earth.
Dollars.
Oh, dollars. Got it. Okay. Carry on.
With an annual growth rate of 10.4% from 2024. Listeners in the U.S., 52% of adults have listened to an audiobook. 38% have listened to an audiobook in the last year. 75% of Gen Z listens to audiobooks over reading physical books.
Okay.
There's a 9% decrease in reading physical books.
Okay.
With a 75% increase of in listening audiobooks. To audiobooks in okay. that in Gen Z and Gen Alpha.
Okay.
This make you blessed?
Okay, I have mixed feelings about this. On the one hand, while there's plenty of trash out there in the book world, if we are listening to audiobooks, which are generally speaking longer form than kind of like hot take news commentary, which is just trash, then I'm blessed by that. I'm at the gym this morning and I see on the TVs the like talking head shows of all the, you know, people analyzing to death Sunday's football games. And I'm just like, who is watching this garbage? So if people are listening to books as opposed to opinion talk radio or things like that, I'm totally blessed by that. If they're listening to books instead of watching nonsense on YouTube, plenty of good stuff on YouTube, but lots of nonsense as well, or nonsense on social media, I'm blessed by that. I guess I'm projecting a little bit from like a learning standpoint, because for me, an audiobook is only for either a topic where I don't need to get all the details, like say a biography, or just recently there was a topic where like I didn't need to take like a super deep nuanced dive, but I just wanted to get a lot of material quickly. So I've been listening to audiobooks on a certain topic, but if I'm going to really understand what's going on, that's got to be a Kindle book or a physical book where I can make notes. So I don't know. I'm torn here. I'm very pro reading, and people need to read, and reading is good for us in lots of different ways. But, you know, different people process information differently, and I know people who are like, yeah, I can't read worth a darn in terms of understanding things, but audiobooks make me want to, you know, or really help me get information into my brain. So I'm just rambling now to avoid answering the question. So I'm going to say I am blessed by this because I am pro-reading, pro-learning, pro-engaging with long-form complex ideas as opposed to little snippets. Personally, books are better for me, but that might not be the case for others. So I'm into it. And I love that Gen Z is listening to books because, I mean, I've seen the stats of, I mean, some crazy percentage of adults like don't even finish a single book in their lives after high school. So that Gen Z is engaging with book-length content at all, I'm blessed by that. How about you?
I am blessed by it, okay. But I'm also an audiobook fiend.
Okay.
I checked my stats this morning. I listen to about 100 books a year.
Wow.
Now, they're not all...
How many are Dr. Seuss?
102. But yes, do the math.
Wow.
Yeah, so... But, so for me, the audiobook has replaced a lot of entertainment.
Yeah.
For me, and I get to do it while I'm doing yard work, yep. while I'm doing, you know, traveling back and forth, while I'm doing like mundane, like admin stuff that I have to do with my job from time to time.
Yeah.
Like, that kind of stuff. Like I can listen to that. It just, it replaces things for me. With you though, if it's something I'm trying to learn yeah. and try to hold on to, I prefer a physical book.
Yeah.
And I still know how to read,
good.
Which is really important for this conversation and everybody listening to know.
Just so we're clear.
I do know how to read them words. And so, but yeah, I think it's great if it's replacing, like you said, short form entertainment options yeah. like TikTok videos, Instagram videos, YouTube shorts, all the things that my kids love. Like, if it replaces that and it gives people something to hold on to, I think it's great because yep. it's a lot like a lot of Netflix series now where yep. they're 10 and a half hours of content for one season of shows
yeah.
that people will binge and right. they'll long form watch that,
yeah.
which is, I think, a lot better for your brain than these short snippet dopamine hits
totally.
And then move on to something else.
Yep.
And the listening to a book, listening to a great narrator is wildly entertaining, and it awakes your imagination. It awakes, you know, the mental pictures that you can create. I think it's all really good.
Yeah. So real quick as we wrap up, where do you get your audiobooks, or what is your audiobook?
I'm an Audible guy.
Audible.
And I know other people who use the, you know, things you don't have to pay for and you get the same content. And that's great.
You like to actually pay the people that are doing the work.
I like to pay the people who are doing the work. I also like to own it forever, even if I get rid of that app. I don't lose all the content. Because I will re-listen to books as well.
All right. Well, hey, read, listen, whatever. Consume those books, right?
That's right.
I think we're both blessed by that. Hey, thanks for joining us for Engaging Culture. We'll be back next week. Bye-bye.